This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. A lot of things to talk about today. One of them is going to be about preserving wealth once you've acquired it.
And speaking of acquiring wealth, we know a lot of you listeners out there are actually entrepreneurs, independent business owners, people who have your own corporations you're working with. What happens when you decide you want to sell that corporation? What are the things you should be thinking about? What's the timing going to look like? How's it going to feel? We're actually going to have our guest, Dick Gregerson from Janus Consulting, talk to us a little bit about prepping to sell your company.
And getting to today's topic, we're going to be talking about asset protection. It is really one of the few areas that you can control during retirement. So suppose you sold a company, maybe you've been saving for retirement, and you've acquired this wealth. Now we're going to talk about protecting it, because investments are really a very important factor that you have complete control. You can't control your Social Security. You can't control, let's say, what the Fed's policy is. But what you can do is control your assets. So whether you've saved for it, you sold a business, maybe you've been saving through a 401k plan at work, a 403b plan, 457 plan, well, we're going to be talking about today, all right, you've acquired it, now you have it. Let's talk about how to protect that nest egg in the new normal.
And Jim, I think this whole idea of knowing what to do with your nest egg is pretty critical. And again, like you mentioned, when you're in retirement, there's a certain amount of things that you really have no control over. You know, your Social Security payout's going to be what it's going to be. Same thing with your pension payout. You really don't have a lot of control over how long you live, although you can make decisions that could prolong your lifespan. You know, medical expenses are hard to control. The interest rate environment that you're in, like you mentioned, we can't really control Fed policy. So one of the few areas over which you can exercise a great deal of control in retirement in terms of your resources is your investment portfolio, which is why it's so critical to make a plan for that particular portion of your retirement life.
Now, this is going to probably sound passe, and you've probably heard this before, but one of the best known ways to protect a nest egg, believe it or not, folks, is diversification. I know it seems very simple, but here's the thing. Very few investors practice it. There's a tendency that we see today to go all in an investment when it's trending. Think of, let's say, tech stocks in the 90s. Think of real estate and gold in the last decade, or even CDs in the 80s. You remember those days when you used to get double digits and you got toasters, Vegematics? I mean, there was really no hard decision making. And people tended to stick to one area. People that put all their money in CDs got a big surprise when it came to the 90s in the chairmanship of Alan Greenspan, because he lowered interest rates dramatically from the 87 crisis, also to the 91 recession in the Gulf War. And he did that periodically throughout the 90s, whether it was 1997, 98, then also in the last decade, beginning in 2001, where he began to bring the Fed funds rate down to 1%, and eventually Bernanke would bring it down to where it is today, a quarter of a point.
Well, Jim, I was just thinking about all the things that, you know, our investors that we talk to have been through in the last few decades, and we talk about this all the time, especially after 2008, I think even more so than after 2000. I think 2000, although people were shocked, I think that they went back into the market, you know, within a couple of years because they decided that it was time to risk again. I think after the 08 market, people who had maybe waited a couple of years after the 2000 crash are still waiting. They're still waiting for that next shoe to drop. Just talked to a guy this afternoon, in fact, a very nice gentleman, who said to me, you know, I'm the person you describe on the podcast. I'm the person who went into cash and gold after 08 because I was so traumatized by the market, and I've been watching the market go up ever since, and I just don't know what to do. Just really feeling traumatized. And, you know, with zero interest rates and what's happened with the market since then, it can really be hard for someone to know, when do I get back in? What do I do? What's an appropriate way to invest? And again, investing isn't haphazard. It should be purposeful. Everything in your portfolio should have a goal, should have a purpose. And it can't have a goal and it can't have a purpose if you don't have a plan. So you need to have a plan. I feel like I say this all the time, Jim, but you need to have a plan.
Well, you know, we've seen this playing out, Kathleen, over the last 3 years. I mean, Kyle Bass came up with the Widowmaker strategy, and he's talked about people that either try to short Japanese bonds or short the market. And the problem is you're going against central banks. In a word of caution, they got a lot more money than you do. And you're going to lose either by shorting or staying in cash. And we've probably seen this decade. You know, we've been at 0% interest rates. We're going on year 7. And Kathleen, we can easily see this. Janet Yellen has made it very clear in her press conferences. She is not eager to begin raising interest rates. And you know, no politician in Washington in a presidential election cycle is going to want to see the Fed crashing the economy by raising rates. I just don't think they're going to do that in the new normal, because financial repression is designed to keep interest rates artificially low. So that's the environment that we're operating in today. And a lot of people are looking for one magical answer. They're looking for one investment, whether it was bond funds in 2009, whether it was gold in 2011. They're looking for one investment that it's going to do everything for them. The problem is, one investment doesn't do that.
Yeah, there ain't no such thing as the perfect investment for all seasons, unfortunately. You know, Jim, you were talking about the low interest rate environment. What that really means for investors, and the bottom line is that things like CDs and bonds are paying a lot less interest than they used to 8, 9, 10 years ago. And so if you're tired of being in bonds or being in CDs and not making a whole lot in terms of yield, you know, you might be thinking about looking at the stock market. But Jim, just from the people I've been talking to, isn't it really an issue now of people that have been out of the market for a while, just waiting for that next correction to come, that next shoe to drop? Isn't the issue now that the market just keeps climbing higher and higher and higher? And so people get more and more and more nervous and more worried about a correction, and they just don't want to get in. I mean, isn't that kind of the big problem that we see?
Well, the problem is that's what happens in a bull market, Kathleen. Markets keep going up. They keep hitting new records. I mean, you think of that in the 80s and 90s. Nobody thought twice about it until about the 90s, around 1995, when interest rates had come down from high single digits down into the low mid-digit range. All of a sudden, people were looking for returns. Well, what was returning the highest return at that time? It was stocks. They were going up double digits. Liquidity, the technology revolution that we were experiencing as the country, a disinflationary environment for the economy, and everybody was feeling good. Now, the problem is, as the market goes up, you know, we're more likely to get a correction. We had one in February. It was about 6%. Here's the problem if you're trying to time the market. Nobody knows when that correction is going to be. They don't know how big it will be, nor do they know the event that will trigger it. And investors who try to time the market often fail. They turn investing into sort of like an all-or-nothing game, going all into the stocks in the late 90s, all into real estate or mortgage investments or gold, or what they've done since 2009 is all into bonds.
You keep talking about this idea. It's almost like a herd mentality in a way, Jim, where, and I think this is just a human nature thing. We all want to go and do what everyone else is doing and be successful at what's making everyone else successful. Why do you think investors do this? Why do you think that they sort of ignore this whole idea that one of the basic principles of investing, which is a diversification? You know, so many of the experts that we interview on the program talk about the importance of diversification among sectors, sometimes among asset classes. You know, it's taught in every investment course. Why do you think it is that this is still a concept a lot of investors understand, maybe in their intellect, but have a hard time implementing when it comes to their own portfolios?
I think it probably stems, Kathleen, from one of the oldest mistakes made in investing, and that's chasing returns. Whatever's hot 1 year, everybody says, that's where I want to be because returns were so high. I want some of that. And you see this often. A hot sector 1 year underperforms the following year, and what was underperforming then becomes the best sector. It almost reminds me of that biblical verse, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And it's a good example is 2014. Bonds and utilities and commodities have been the stellar performers in the market so far this year. Stocks are up. Stocks were up 8% in the first half of the year. But, you know, gold stocks are up double digits. Bond prices, which were down double digits last year, are up high single digits this year. So what underperforms in 1 year tends to outperform in the following year. The problem is people are chasing last year's performance, and that's what they're doing. They're chasing returns.
Well, Jim, when you're talking about chasing returns, you know, I'm thinking about how different that is from an investor who's trying to preserve wealth. You know, it's one strategy to pursue growth in your portfolio, a completely different strategy to preserve wealth. So why don't we talk about some of the basics of preserving wealth in your portfolio? I'm thinking about this whole idea again of diversification, or not putting all of your financial eggs in the same basket.
It starts with understanding the secular trend of the market. Are we in a bull market, in a bear market? Because obviously, how you diversify in terms of a bull or bear market are going to be much different. You're going to be a lot more defensive, a lot more conservative in a secular bear market as you would, let's say, secular bull market. So the first thing you want to do is understand the larger macro trend of the market. That tells you what asset class you want to favor in your portfolio. And secondly, it begins in understanding what your income and your lifestyle needs are. Everybody's a little different. Everybody spends a little different. Some people spend more than others. And that is going to determine what you need for income. And that will determine how much of an asset class you're going to emphasize in your diversification strategy. It's based more on your personal needs rather than saying, okay, here's a pie chart. Here's my age. This is what I should do. Here's the assets I acquired, and here's the cookie cutter formula. Well, there's a lot more things that go beyond it. How you diversify always depends on what kind of trend you're investing in. In other words, what's the condition of the markets? And secondly, your own personal needs. And one of the things, when you've acquired it, you've saved for it all your life, you've finally gotten to retirement, or you just sold your company, you are looking for secure sources of income. Obviously, if you have a wonderful pension, you have Social Security, sometimes we've run across people where that can be something that takes care of a good majority of your needs. But also, the size of the portfolio also determines the allocation mix. Obviously, if you're very wealthy, you have a large amount of money, you want to stay wealthy. You don't want to go back to work. You don't want to lose those assets. So under no circumstances, whether your need for income or whatever the macro environment is, would you ever put all your eggs in one basket.
I want to think about this for a minute, Jim. You know, we have a lot of our clients who sold businesses recently, and they end up with these fairly nice chunks of change. And, you know, what do you do with that once you have it? You've got interest rates near 0%, so I don't really want to put it in a CD at a bank. We've been through two huge bear markets, you know, that have decimated a lot of people's portfolios. So I'm not really sure I want to put it in the market. I'm not really convinced about the economy recovering, so I've got this huge chunk of money that's going to help me keep from having to work again after I've sold my business and retired. How do I protect that in this environment?
Well, I mean, you have to understand the fear factor. It hasn't changed. You know, the prudence of diversification in a portfolio, you know, even people like Warren Buffett, they might concentrate in certain sectors of the market, but Warren Buffett is not going to put everything he owns in stocks. There are times, based on the macro environment, he'll use arbitrage trades. There are times he's been known to invest and trade in and out of bonds. But, you know, here's one thing that I wanted to really do and emphasize is I wanted to take one of the worst investment environments. In the worst investment environment, and pick a time to invest at the wrong time. Let's say that you came in, you sold your company, you got all your money, or you retired on January 1st, 2008, and you put that money to work. Now, this is a hypothetical example, but we took a look at where bond rates were back in during that period of time, because we were buying bonds. And we also took a look at where the stock market was. You know, stocks like Coca-Cola, Exxon, what were they on January 1st of 2008? However, had you basically diversified your portfolio in 2008, you would have survived and thrived during the crisis. You wouldn't have experienced a loss of income. Your portfolio would have been down in the single digits, no more than the correction we saw this year in the 6 and 7% range. No more than a correction despite the scary headlines. The portfolio would have included bonds, which would have been laddered, stocks, which would have been blue chips, and some cash. And, you know, for most people, that's a basic diversification plan. You can throw in real estate, you can throw in some precious metals in the mix, but, you know, that is basically what we call diversification.
Well, Jim, when you talk about this hypothetical portfolio, we've talked about this in the past, but, you know, maybe we should revisit again in a little bit more detail, because it sort of validates the point that if you're looking to preserve wealth, that diversification is a really good tool, especially during market downturns, in terms of preserving overall portfolio value. So why don't we talk a little bit about that model portfolio and the way it preserves wealth?
Well, this portfolio was very typical of what you see, Kathleen, in large portfolios and especially larger estates where allowance is made for growth. But you have enough predictable income streams that are not totally dependent on investments for all income. It could be somebody that's retired that has a very generous pension, they have Social Security, or maybe you sold a business for a substantial amount of money. You have a large amount of assets which you can use to create that stability and income. And one of the things I wanted to stress, and I picked this point, was, you know, January of 2008. Now, suppose you would have picked, let's say, 50% of your portfolio were in laddered bonds. Around that time, probably closer to 4-4.5% interest. 40% would have been in blue chip stocks, think Coca-Cola, Dow stocks, Exxon, and 10% in cash. Now, here's what would have happened to that portfolio at the bottom of the crisis, which was March of 2009. By March of 2009, your bond portfolio of $500,000, and I'm using a $1 million example in this case, your bond portfolio would have been up 10%, so it would have been up $50,000. And then $400,000 in stocks, they would have been down 30%, creating a $120,000 loss. Cash obviously would have been neutral. So back out the $120,000 loss against the $50,000 gains in bonds, you would have been down 7% in the worst crisis that we've experienced as a country since the Great Depression. Now, here's something to think about. Your income did not change. It actually went up. The fixed income portfolio that was laddered, it didn't go down or the dividends weren't cut like in a bond fund. That would have never changed. Your stock portfolio, a lot of those companies, Coca-Cola, Exxon, all of them were increasing their dividends in 2008 and 2009. So even though your stocks went down, their dividends didn't go down. The dividends went up. You would have not seen a single change to your lifestyle.
And Jim, I want to just talk about this for a minute, because you've mentioned in this example, again, this is an example of preserving wealth, is you've really emphasized the use of these really large cap blue chip stocks like Coca-Cola, Exxon, and about how they tend to sort of recover from downturns fairly successfully. Again, we can't ever say that they're going to always do that, but they have historically performed that way. Why is it that you're recommending this or saying that this is something to consider for folks who are in their retirement years versus maybe going after a more glamorous, hot name stock like a Facebook or a Groupon, for example?
You know, this goes back to Ben Graham's rules for defensive investor. And if anybody hasn't heard of Ben Graham, he's really the father of fundamental analysis. Graham and Dodd security analysis is a classic in the industry. He was Warren Buffett's mentor, but he wrote a book called The Intelligent Investor, and I highly recommend it for any investor. And he had the rules for the stock component of a portfolio, and especially for a defensive or, let's say, a conservative investor wanting to preserve wealth. And he had three or four characteristics that would make up a stock portfolio. One, there should be adequate diversification. Graham did not recommend putting all your eggs in a Tesla or a Netflix or one stock. And that usually meant 10 to 15 stocks with maybe a maximum of 30. Secondly, he talked about each company selected would be a large, prominent, and conservatively financed company. What we call blue chip stocks, companies that have strong balance sheets, have a strong business franchise. Third, and this is very important, especially for preserving wealth and income, each company would have a long record of continuous dividend payments. And the acid test of dividends were the Great Depression. And if you take a look at, we had another acid test, which was called the Great Recession. And if companies maintain their dividends, in fact, increase them, you know you have one of those companies. And fourth, he talked about the price that you paid to buy those stocks. You know, you could buy a great blue chip company, strong balance sheet, everything else is going for it, but if you buy it at the wrong time when it's overpriced, always pay attention to what you're buying. That's what you do when you go shopping. And so these are one of the things that Graham talked about. And there's a reason, Kathleen, they're called blue chips. They're the only kind of stocks for really retired wealthy investors. And you're not looking at this point in your life to roll the dice or chase what's hot. You got to get away from that. And in the new normal, you need to be more risk adverse. You've got a lot more intervention in the market. There are a lot more chances for black swan events. But here's another thing. Due to technology, something we talked about, all the innovation on the show over the weekend, People are living longer. They don't want to start over. And if you built a sizable nest egg, you want to preserve it. Why do you want to roll the dice? I mean, you look at large estates, Kennedys, Rockefellers. There's two aspects that you'll learn about their style of investing. Number one, they're defensive and conservative. Yes, they're large enough and they're wealthy enough that they can put a small amount of their capital into startups or something that might be risky, but it's a small amount of what they have available. The majority of their assets, fixed income, and blue chip stocks. And they've learned the power of compounding and not touching principal. And that's one of the great things that you get in a blue chip stock.
Well, Jim, I think the example of the Kennedys is a great one because they're one of the families that have managed to somehow circumvent what they call the shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, which is where the first generation works really, really hard to build up the wealth. The second generation spends most of the wealth and passes a little bit on to this third generation, but the third generation gets so little of the wealth, they end up working really hard again. And I think this whole idea of preserving wealth is a really important concept for people who want to leave a legacy for their children and beyond, for, you know, generations to come. And Jim, why don't we make this a little bit more tangible for our readers by talking about a couple that we've talked to who were in the situation where they had sold a business, got a sizable chunk of change, and just were looking beyond the now to many, many years from now, how to preserve their wealth throughout their lifetime and pass on a really nice nest egg to their kids and beyond. This couple came in to see us. They were fairly young for retirees. Amar was 55, Leah 52. The Singhs were just a really great couple. They were actually first-generation immigrant kids. Their parents were from India. Parents had worked really, really hard to provide a good lifestyle for them, really focused on their education, like a lot of immigrant families tend to do. And so Amar and Leah really felt that it was important to pass that same work ethic on to their kids. And their kids have done well. You know, they've got four kids scattered all over the U.S. now. You know, one's an orthopedic surgeon, one's a marketing exec, one's a teacher, one's an engineer. So their kids have done well for themselves. They've been successful at passing on that work ethic and that importance and focus on education. But this couple had been working together for many, many years. They had a small mom-and-pop software company that had been producing a product that had become to the attention of a bigger software company. And they decided to go ahead and explore the idea of selling their company a little earlier than they had thought and exploring the whole idea of retiring earlier than, again, than they had thought they could. And before they made this decision to sell, Jim, they did something I think is a really critical first step for people thinking about selling a business. They came to us before they sold their business and said, how much do we have to net from the sale of our business to be able to maintain our lifestyle and pass our wealth untouched onto our kids? So we ran some formulas for them and told them they needed to net around $6 million from the sale of their business to be able to, again, live the lifestyle that they wanted and pass the wealth down to their kids. So interesting thing about the sale is they went ahead and made the sale. They got the purchase price they wanted. They did net the $6 million. One thing that happened to Amar, which is pretty typical of business buyouts, is he was under contract to work for another year for the company that purchased them. But after that, he was going to be able to retire. So by the time he was 56 and Leah 53, they would both be retired. So again, really young couple to be retiring at this age.
And more importantly, they had a couple things going, not only just the sale of the business, but also they were big believers investing in real estate and owning that real estate free and clear. So they had a brownstone and Rittenhouse neighborhood in Philadelphia. That was about $500,000 in net worth, no mortgage. They had a vacation home in Florida that was worth $600,000, no mortgage on that. They had the savings, roughly about $50,000. Interesting, in this particular case, there really wasn't any pension. There wasn't any IRAs or anything like that. Most of what they had in investing, they poured it into real estate. They wanted a free and clear home. They wanted a free and clear home as a vacation home as well, in case they wanted to go down to Florida to escape the harsher winters in the Midwest. So they didn't really have any retirement accounts. Everything was always funneled back into the business or their personal real estate.
And Jim, I think this couple is really interesting because they represent, which I think a lot of couples don't really think about, which is that there are more than one phases to your retirement plan. And this couple is a great example of that. There's actually three phases to their retirement plan that we had to plan out for them. The first phase, which was short, was the period during which Leah was retired, but Amar was still under contract with the purchasing company. So during that first year, Amar's income, which was $150,000 from its contract, was going to more than cover their $8,000 a month expenses. No problem there. So the first phase of their retirement is that 1 year when Amar is working. Totally fine. No problems there. What happens once Amar's contract ends? They have no pension, no savings for retirement. They're not eligible for Social Security yet. That means that all of their expenses have to come out of their investment portfolio somehow. And when we talked to Amar and Leah, they told us, you know, look, we have worked so hard on our company. We have been so focused on our company. We took vacations down in Florida with our family, but that's it. We really haven't done anything else as far as vacations. It's been nose to the grindstone. When Amar finally is able to fully retire, we want to really explore the world. We want to do some luxury vacations. We want to go and see all these wonderful places we've always wanted to see and just been working too hard to go and see. We want to spoil ourselves a little bit. And so they actually anticipated that when they were fully retired, their expenses will actually go up $3,000 a month. So their total monthly expenses in retirement would be $11,000 to cover all this extra travel. So again, in this particular phase, we had to meet that income need with their investments and savings. And again, their investments would come from the $6 million from the sale of the business and then the modest savings they had in their checking account.
And here was, I guess, maybe a happy upside story for both Amar and Leah, is down the road, the plan was to cover expenses during this period where they retire, but not drawing their Social Security yet, because if they could stay and wait to full retirement age at age 66, the benefits would be much larger, and they didn't really need it at this point, since the income they were receiving would be above what they were expending, including the luxury vacations and the cruises. So what we did is we did a $3 million laddered portfolio, roughly about 4%. That was averaging about $10,000 a month for inflationary sort of increases, because you don't want to put everything in fixed income. And that's one of the things you do about preserving wealth. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. So we did $2.5 million roughly in dividend paying blue chip stocks. They were roughly about 2%. That gave them $4,000 a month. So they had $11,000 of expenses, $14,000 of income coming in, and they just felt a comfort level with a lot of cash. I think secretly, I think Amar is thinking of buying another piece of real estate. It's my own opinion. But anyway, we had a $500,000 plus what they had in checking. So we had roughly about $550,000 in cash, $2.5 million in stocks, and $3 million in a laddered bond portfolio.
And Jim, I want to just circle back on this point a little bit, because we knew that there was going to be this fairly long span between Amar's full retirement and them drawing Social Security where they'd have to live on their investments. That's where we got that $6 million net number from the sale of their business, was to cover this chunk of time when they wouldn't have any other source of income except their investments. So again, if you're thinking about selling a business, do some planning with your financial planner first. So again, I mentioned that this was a plan that had three phases. Amar working full-time for a year and Leah retired. A time when they were both retired but not yet eligible for Social Security. And then we move into phase three. When Amar finally reaches full retirement age at 66, you know, he can draw about $3,000 a month in Social Security. And his wife will be 63 at the time, so she'll draw Social Security a little bit early at about $1,500 a month. At that point in time, we're going to rebalance their portfolio a little bit. And again, we're going to keep revisiting them with this every few years to make sure that we're still on track to do this. But our thinking right now is that when they reach phase three of their retirement is to put a little bit less in bonds, because they don't need as much dependable income because that's being made up with their Social Security. So we'll reduce their bond allocation down to $2 million. And if we're still able to get around 4%, that would give them about $7,000 a month in bond income. And we're going to up the dividend paying portion of their portfolio, because again, we don't really need to focus quite as much on the dependable income. We can focus more on the growth and on the growth of the income stream here. So we'll put about $3.5 million in dividend paying stocks. And if those are paying around 2.5%, that'll give them about $6,000 a month in income from the dividend payers. So net net, they'll end up with about $17,500 a month in income. And if we assume, which is the number we used for them, if we assume roughly a 2.5% to 3% inflation rate, their expenses at that time are going to be up from $11,000 a month to around $15,000 a month or more. So even with the effects of an inflationary situation happening, by that point in time, they'll be able to more than meet their income needs every month. So I think, Jim, again, looking at their retirement in its full progression, like you always say, not just to retirement, but through retirement, and making a different plan for each different stage of their retirement is part of what helped us be able to give them that purchase price target for their business sale, but also help them feel comfortable with each phase of their retirement.
And I think this is what happens in larger estates, Kathleen. You can see this when you read about it in Forbes magazine about some of the great fortunes, especially when they're passed on and held, unless it's still in the family business, like, you know, maybe a Fortune 500 company where the majority of, let's say, assets are in that company stock, but it's a blue chip company at that time. And I think that this is one of the important things that you have to think about. If you've acquired wealth, you're in the process of getting wealthy, you don't need to take a lot of risk, but you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. There isn't one surefire investment. And that's what I was trying to demonstrate when we were talking about that portfolio. Had you bought it the worst time possible, January 1st, 2008, just before Lehman Brothers and all the crazy things that happened in the fall of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009, when the market finally bottomed, when stocks were down over 40%, real estate was down 40%, had you had a diversified portfolio, fixed income, laddered bond portfolio, blue chip stocks, you would have suffered maybe a single digits. Your income and your lifestyle would have never changed. In fact, you would have got a pay hike right in the middle of the crisis. And that goes back to what Benjamin Graham talked about, how a defensive investor chooses the stocks that go in their portfolio. They buy blue chips, and there's a reason. They have withstood bull markets, bear markets, recessions, depressions, as well as raging economies. And that's the key to preserving wealth.
Well, Jim, again, I'm just thinking about those folks that we talk to that sell businesses and end up realizing these big chunks of change, or maybe they inherit money suddenly. They've got this big amount of money that they've never really had before. They don't really know what to do with it. I think in preparation for that, as we mentioned, good to go see your financial planner, but also good to think through that whole process of selling your business. So I think for those of us out there who are business owners and just want to kind of imagine or walk ourselves through mentally what it might be like to sell our business, we've got Dick Gregerson, the president of Janus Associates, coming up on the program next to talk about prepping your business for sale. Welcome, Financial Sense listeners. We've realized over the years that a lot of you are actually independent business owners, people who are entrepreneurs or have built a business from the ground up. And we've realized that a lot of you are approaching retirement and trying to figure out, how do you exit the business? How do you monetize the business? How do you sell the business? How do you pass it on? So today we're going to talk a little bit with Dick Gregerson of Janus Consulting, who's going to walk us through some of the steps and processes to go about selling your business through a private equity firm. Well, Dick, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that you and I had discussed a little bit ago about financing a merger and acquisition of a business. I just wanted to sort of start off the conversation with a discussion about how that particular area of business is looking right now.
Well, it's looking quite good. I think it's taken most of the industry a little bit by surprise, how active the M&A market is at the moment. And a big piece of that is that the banks are lending. And during that period of time when the banks weren't lending, there were a number of non-bank financial institutions that raised money that are providing senior and subordinated debt. And they're now leveraging up transactions kind of like it was 2007. So that created a very liquid market for private equity as well as for strategic buyers to get in the marketplace and buy up companies.
Well, Dick, I'm just thinking about a lot of our listeners out there who may own a piece of a business or own a business, in terms of how does a business owner go about accessing the private equity markets, and why would they choose to do so?
Well, they would choose to do that now maybe more than where we've traditionally been. Private equity firms raised a lot of commitments back in 2006, 7, and 8. And those commitments typically last for 7 to 8 years. And those commitments wind up running out after a lot of it during this year. In fact, it was reported that there's $100 billion that needs to be put to work over the period of 2014 that otherwise will expire. So from the standpoint of sellers, this is a particularly good time to sell their company at a very favorable prices. In fact, the multiples that are out there now are actually better than 2007 for what's considered to be middle market companies, companies that would sell for between $25 million and $1 billion. And so the company may not be making the best earnings ever, and you might be a little bit reluctant about saying, I should just let this thing percolate for another year, but you could wind up with a significantly lower sell price next year when there's less pressure on the buyers to go out and make deals than it is today. Today, there's just a lot of money looking to do deals and not that many companies that are on the marketplace to fill up that need. Now, in terms of how you go after private equity firms, the problem with private equity firms at the moment is that they are very accessible, which means that they're looking at thousands of one-page letters of inquiry that say, here's my company, it's in this business, revenues look like this, earnings look like that. And out of those thousands, they may look at 100 transactions that are available, and they will typically close on somewhere in a normal year on two or three of those. So it's difficult to get access to private equity unless they're looking for a company specifically like the one that you own. And instead, what typically is done is that you have a investment bank put together an offering memorandum that gives the private equity firm all the information that they need to decide whether or not they're interested in looking further at the company, enough so that they would want to come out and schedule a trip and give an indication of what they think the value might be. And I have to say that we just went to market with a company, nice business, not what you consider a breakthrough technology or anything like that. It's just a good service company. 2 years ago, for a company like this, we might have had three or four private equity firms after going out and contacting 60 or 80 potentials that would want to come in and take a look at the company. This year, we have 20. And the valuation that we got on that particular business was the best strategic buyer that was out there offered $10 million for the business, and three private equity firms all came in at around $15 million instead. So in that particular owner's situation, for him to do as well a year or two from now as he did in this last go-round, he probably would have to see his way to a 20 or 30 or even a 50% increase in sales to command the same kind of price.
So what you're saying is we're basically in sort of a sweet spot in terms of doing an acquisition or a merger right now, of selling your company in particular, just that there's a lot of activity happening, a lot of liquidity out there looking for a home. And so we sort of have this limited time frame, probably through the end of the year, you're thinking, where you sort of have this ideal time to be looking for a buyer for your business if you're planning on getting out in the next couple, 3 years.
Absolutely right. And one way that you know that it's a hot market is that the private equity firms themselves that made deals back in 2006 are cashing in on this increased activity, and they are now selling a record number of the businesses that they own as well. So the smart money recognizes that this is an unusual period of time in which someone can take advantage of the mismatch between supply and demand.
Well, it sounds like an ideal time to sell a business. If I'm a business owner and I'm thinking about selling my business or making my business look attractive to an outside buyer, what are some of the steps I might take or the things I might look at to sort of get my business into good shape to look attractive as an acquisition?
Preparation a couple of years in advance is a particularly good thing. But as a business owner, you need to think about three areas that we typically find that a business owner has not thought a lot about. One is you need to invest in having your accountants do a higher level of review of your financial statements so that there's more credibility in how those things are presented. So a lot of entrepreneurs just have their results compiled by an accountant, and now to get confidence from the buyers, you really should go to reviewed or even audited statements. You should think about what kind of money you need to get out of the business, and you need to talk with a financial planner about what your life might look like on the other side of a transaction, because there's certainly never a point, in our opinion, of going out there and spending a lot of time and effort on something without knowing that the end result is going to be satisfactory. And the third thing to do is to take care of all those little problems that you have been putting off. And, you know, we're all guilty of things. There are things about each entrepreneur's business that they really love to do. And then there's stuff that they just hope will work itself out. And, you know, they do what they have to. But when it comes to selling the company, at the end of the day, you can't sell your problems to a third party. You have to solve the problems or you will pay for it in the purchase price. So the three things are financial statement, upgrade and preparation, clearing up some of those niggling problems that you just haven't had time to address for one reason or another, And third is to think about what your life is going to look like on the other side of a transaction. Talk with a financial planner about where you might invest and what your lifestyle is going to look like.
Right, because the last thing you want to do is sell your business for too little and end up in a situation where you have to go back to work again.
That's right. And, you know, Janus is both a management consulting firm and an investment bank. And the reason why we have that combination is that what we found with a lot of owners is that sometimes by waiting a few years and going after some things that for one reason or another you haven't done, maybe a new product you haven't launched or a customer that you refuse to sell to because you think they're unreasonable or you've had problems with them in the past, that there may be some low-hanging fruit there. And so even though this is a very exciting market at the moment, you know, it would not be out of the question to wait for a while and take care of that. For instance, we helped a manufacturer in the plastic card business here in Los Angeles, gift cards and loyalty cards, that kind of stuff. And the company had been stuck at $15 million in sales and $3 million in earnings, and we helped them hire in a great sales guy. It was a Chinese owner, and he spoke English way better than I spoke Chinese, but even with that said, there was still some communication problems with customers. And now, 5 years later, the company has doubled in sales and tripled in income and quadrupled in value. So sometimes there is that low-hanging fruit out there, and part of taking a look at the business is not only do you have opportunities that are like that, then you need to make a choice as to whether you want to develop those opportunities yourself or whether you'd rather sell a portion of the business out to a private equity firm, use their money and let them take the risks, and you share in a portion of the upside in the company as it's developed.
And how would that actually work as far as selling a piece of the company, have a private equity firm participate? Describe a scenario where that might actually be beneficial for a company that's thinking about eventually looking for someone to acquire them?
Yeah. Well, for instance, we had a client that was in the bottle distribution business, and they'd taken the company about as far as they wanted to go and made a very comfortable living for all the members of the family. But as the parents wanted to retire and really only one son was left working in the business, they decided to use a private equity firm. In this particular case, it was Bain Capital, came in and bought out 80% of the company. And the family sold it for $15 million. The son remained, got a bunch of stock options, and put $1 million back into the company. Inside 3 years, they paid him another $5 million. He let $1 million of that ride. 2 years later, he wound up with another $6 million. What was going on was the private equity firms changed over. There were a couple of different that owned them, but they went out and continued to make acquisitions, and they're buying companies at a low multiple, and then they were able to turn around and sell the whole company at a high multiple because they were so much larger. And he wound up getting more money based on letting that $1 million ride and harvesting those than he did on the initial sale.
So it sounds like another option for someone who's thinking about making their business attractive to an outside company is, like you were mentioning, to make some strategic hires to help your company's profitability improve. And you also sort of alluded to a situation where some strategic acquisitions were made as well. So how does that work as far as how do you know it's time to do a strategic acquisition, or what types of situations would lend themselves to a strategic acquisition making your company a lot more attractive to an outside buyer?
Well, as far as outside buyers are concerned, they build value in a couple of different ways. One way is geographically. So if you have a distribution company or a regional manufacturing company, acquiring a similar business in a different locale and proving that it can perform in the same way as your company has means that your business model is scalable, and private equity firms will pay a lot more money for a scalable enterprise. And what they like to do is to then take that two-horse barn and turn it into a 12 or 14-horse herd of related companies that have used your same kind of business model and expand in that way. The other thing that they like to do is to have companies that have a more complete offering to customers, particularly in the case where those business offerings, the decision to buy those services or products are being made by the same people that are buying from the company. It doesn't help to be somebody wholesaling paper to someone and then decide that, you know, we really ought to sell office chairs. That doesn't really work. But selling paper and toner, which are related purchases, probably would be a great expansion for somebody's business. And so what the private equity firms try to do when they go ahead and make these acquisitions is to fill in that dance card, either geographically or with products, that makes the company in a more commanding position in its marketplace, creates a larger company with more depth of management. And as a result of that, for the next buyer, it's considered to be a lower risk acquisition, and therefore they pay more money for it.
So all these are examples of ways to make yourself more attractive for an acquisition. I was wondering, you know, we've had several clients of ours sell their businesses in the last year or so, and I think they've all been surprised as far as the process and what it felt like on the other side. Many of them are still involved in consulting arrangements that were part of the sell deal. Would you mind talking a little bit about what the business owner and key personnel can expect as far as ongoing commitments to the company that purchased them?
A lot of it depends on how you manage the business. The vast majority of entrepreneurs get into business because they like the hands-on feel of running the company. Unfortunately, that's not the easiest kind of company to sell. So, for instance, we have a client that we're working with right now. He's 60 years old. His accountant told him, look, Bob, if you're going to sell the company, you're so important to the business that any buyer is going to want you to stay on for a while. So maybe you ought to think about selling out a portion of the company. In this case, she recommended about 70 or 80% of the company to a private equity firm because you said you want to stay in the state. As it turns out, his daughter just finished her freshman year at University of San Diego, and he has another one going to college up here in Los Angeles. And he wants to stay in the area for 4 years. And so he's using that period of time as a transition period in which he will stay on with the company. And as a result of that, he's been able to command a superior price for his business. Typically, what private equity firms will expect from an owner that wants to sort of lock the door and leave is a commitment of anywhere between 1 and 2 years as an employee or CEO, COO, some form of continuing engagement in the company with a period where they can also wind up being a consultant. But if you know that you want to sell your company in the next 4 or 5 years, having a private equity company come in and help hire in the mid-level management and that kind of stuff for you and take a lot of the risk off your shoulders also has the benefit for most private owners. It eases the difficult transition of actually having somebody else who's going to be running the business day to day. And I think psychologically, that's one of the hardest things for owners to do is to hire in a chief operating officer under themselves and train that person up and actually delegate. It's a lot easier, we found, for them to sell 80 or 100% of their company, have a big bank account, and act as an advisor and ombudsman to the personnel that get hired in under them to help take over the business in the long run. When you're betting your own money, I think you want to be at the table and place the bets. When you're playing with the house money, I think you're a little more inclined to look over someone's shoulder and help make sure they don't step in anything that's going to get them into trouble. But at the same time, it's just a different bet that you're placing.
This almost sounds to me like a form of business succession planning in a way.
It absolutely is. And one of the nice things is that private equity has figured out over the years that creating an environment that encourages business owners to stay on in the company, run the company on their own, enjoy the benefits of expertise that the private equity firm has. And there's nobody better at acquiring companies than private equity companies. That's all they do all the time. So one of the advantages of partnering with one of them is that most business owners have never bought a company. They've never integrated one in. They've never thought about all the issues that go with multi-locations and different cultures and all that kind of stuff. So bringing on a private equity partner, it's not just money that they're bringing, but it's also expertise in expanding the business in a way that's going to grow value. And, you know, if they paid for 80 or 90% of the value of your company and you know that their objective is to increase the value of the company by at least 20% per year, you stay on for 3 or 4 years and the money that you leave in, you will have probably at least doubled, probably tripled or quadrupled.
So it sounds like this is a really good opportunity for a lot of businesses who are looking to really increase valuation, or maybe for folks who are perhaps approaching retirement and looking for a way to sort of ease themselves out of the business without too much pain.
Absolutely right. And for those owners that want to step away from the business, ironically, the level of activity that private equity is providing in the marketplace is making it harder for strategic buyers. Those companies in the United States that have over $1 trillion of cash on their balance sheet to go out and make the kinds of strategic acquisitions they need to make. And so one of the things that a strategic buyer will find themselves in a position is that the prices getting bid up by the private equity firms because they're kind of in a feeding frenzy. And for them to be able to buy the company, they may make concessions that they wouldn't normally make. And one of those concessions that they're able to make, it's easier for them than a private equity firm, is to say, okay, Mr. Owner, you just stay on for 3 to 6 months. We have bench strength in management. We can put somebody in the company, you train them up, and you can go. So if you don't want to stick around, finding a strategic buyer is a great way to go with that. And we're seeing strategic buyers offering exit packages for executives on much shorter time frames than they normally have in the past, just to be able to give the owner to have an advantage over private equity.
I really like what I'm hearing from you here, because I think it's sort of, for a lot of our clients who own their own businesses, it's that whole exit strategy that's really always problematic as far as passing to the next generation or getting some kind of ongoing income stream from the business. And it sounds like this whole idea of being acquired or even merging is a good way to sort of negotiate that in a way that's pretty smart and also profitable.
Yes, it is. And most business owners don't even think about the possibility of significantly diversifying their portfolio. And in that, I mean that most of them don't think about their business as a stock investment. And yet selling the company or selling a portion of the company under the right circumstances is a way to not only lock in a favorable price in a transition period, but also a way to reduce the risk that you have. And most of these business owners are, in one form or another, personally guaranteeing the debt of the company. So not only do they have the risk of trying to sell the company in the future in a less robust M&A marketplace, but they also have the residual effects of being jointly and severally liable for the debt of the company. So it's a portfolio that doesn't go down to zero. It's a portfolio that, under the worst case circumstances, as we saw in 2008, for some people wound up, it didn't go to zero, it went negative. They wound up having to make good on their guarantees. So what a lot of business owners tell us is they say, oh, we get offers from inquiries from people all the time. And they feel this sense that at any time that they want to, they can sell their business. The fact of the matter is that back in 2005, which was the last normal year that we had for M&A, of the businesses that were put on the market that were considered middle market companies, you know, values of $100 million or less, only 1 in 3 sold. And so if you can pick a time at which you have a higher probability of selling the company, you probably ought to jump in and do it. Now, how does that 1 in 3 selling match up with all these inquiries I got? Well, think back to what I was telling you about the private equity firms. They look at 100 deals that are legitimately on the market where somebody's written up a book, and they close on 2 or 3 of them a year. So if you haven't gotten 30 phone calls from people saying that we might be interested in your business, from a probability standpoint, you can't for sure say that I actually have a buyer out there that's interested in buying my company. So inquiries are cheap, but getting deals closed is difficult. And so that's why we suggest to our clients that when we're in a hot M&A market like now, it's a great time to go out and try to get a deal that is tailor-made to your lifestyle, to your plans for the future, because right now you're kind of in the driver's seat.
You know, this is really interesting to me as well, because again, I just keep thinking about how we're in a sweet spot for so many different reasons, in terms of interest rates and buying a house, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm thinking, you know, this is also a great time to be thinking about selling your business. And do you think it's worth it for most business owners out there who are sort of toying with the idea of selling their business in the next 3 to 5 years to get some form of valuation done to see how attractive their business actually is to an outside buyer?
Particularly if the valuation is done from the standpoint of not just what the business is worth, but what things might be done to enhance the business as well that might make it more saleable. What we tell our clients is that up until now, you've been using your business as a way of serving the needs of your customers. But when you're going about selling your company, your customer now isn't the person that's buying the widgets from you. Your customer is the strategic buyer or the private equity firm, or your kids, if you're passing it to the next generation. And what you need to think about, your company isn't a vehicle to get you someplace. Your company is now a product that you need to sell. And you need to think of where it needs to, you know, have a couple dents rubbed out of it and a little bit of a new paint job and have somebody give it a checkup, which is having the accountant come in and taking care of some of the odds and ends that are out there. And think about, who is it that might be interested in buying this company from me? And we found that by doing that kind of planning, that over the last 10 years at Janus, we've wound up with an 84% success rate on selling companies. And the reason for that is that we insist that our clients do that kind of housekeeping before we take them into market, that we all sit down and think through what the owner wants to do and what alternatives that might seem attractive to them, and then go out and tell their unique story about why this business has survived when so many others have failed, and in the case of selling to a strategic, why they're able to sell to a customer that that strategic hasn't been able to sell to, and why this is a company that they should pay a premium for.
So this is something that really needs to start well in advance of an actual sale. You were mentioning, you know, several years in advance, but at the same time, it's always worth exploring, especially if it's something that you're considering in the next 3 to 5 years, is to go ahead and get some of that, I guess I'm going to call it rehab work, done ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that doesn't mean that in this marketplace at the moment, if you have a company and you haven't done all of these things, but you're saying, you know, I'd like to really find out whether or not I'm saleable and what's going on, there are plenty of investment bankers that would be happy to sit down with you and talk about the pros and cons of going to market and what you might do to enhance the value of the company. And in this market, quite frankly, the buyers are not as picky as they would be in a normal market. So we're finding that there can be a few more dents and dings in your company and still wind up getting very good prices. And the reason for it is, from the standpoint of, we typically talk about the value of a company in terms of multiples of EBITDA that the company's selling for, what its enterprise value is. And in 2013, we're at the highest level of multiples for middle market companies that we've seen in the last 10 years. Multiples for these companies are up 40% from where they were in 2012. And so this is, I hate to use the word bubble, but this is a bubble that your clients ought to be taking advantage of.
Before it bursts.
Before it bursts.
Well, Dick, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program today to talk to our clients about selling their businesses. If people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do so?
You can visit our website at janusconsulting.com, J-A-N-A-S, consulting.com, or januscorp, J-A-N-A-S-C-O-R-P.com, and give us a call. We're at 626-432-7000, located in Pasadena, Hawaii, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, and of course, Texas as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again for talking with us today. I really appreciate your insights.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Well, that concludes this week's program of Lifetime Income. Until we talk to you again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.